Well, hey, everyone. Welcome to this week's show. I'm Lisa Anderson, and let me give you a little taste of what is coming up later in the show. We have got our inbox with Joshua Rogers. You know he loves to share his opinion on things, but it's great because he often has great practical advice. And this week, he is going to advise a guy who is not interested in a girl. And he's kind of a little nervous about just being blunt about it, but should he be? Well, we'll see what Joshua has to say. Then for our culture segment, Dan Dumas is back. He is a professor as well as an author, a pastor, and has written the book Live Smart with just some great principles for really for growing in your Christian faith and into adulthood as well. Okay, so this is going to be an interesting roundtable. We have got Andrew, Brandon, and Ashley back. Hey, guys.
Hey. Hi.
And this is primarily because we're going to talk about ego. So you guys naturally came to mind. And it was like, you know, who really could weigh in on this? Oh, yeah, those three.
Lots of experience.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. So, but it's not like, it's funny because I think when we talk about ego nowadays, you just tend to talk about like jock types or people that are just braggadocious about themselves or so-and-so is egotistical. Mm-hmm. But I think it's actually, you know, there are a lot of spiritual principles that I think play into ways that we can evidence ego or whatever we want to call it. I mean, you know, pride, self, my wants, my needs, my feelings, hat tip to Paul Tripp, all of that as far as, you know, putting ourselves before others and making more of ourselves than we should. And so I want to just kind of dive into that a little bit today. There was actually an article on Hello Christian that talked about ego really restricting you even from God's plan and God's will for your life. And kind of that idea of like when we get in our own way, or our own sin and pride does that. And so this is kind of a loaded question, but I'm going to put it out there anyway. And that is, like, what do you guys think of? I mean, do you think of yourselves when you think of the word ego? I mean, I don't. I think of myself as very self-effacing, very whatever. So I would like to think of myself as not, quote, that prideful person. I mean, I know other people that certainly are. I don't put myself in that category, but I don't know. Is this one of those things that you had to think about, or are you just like, oh, yeah, this is a big struggle for me?
Definitely a struggle for me. I feel like...
What? I know. Do not even strike me. You're just so sweet, Ashley.
Oh,
whatever.
Yeah, stop.
Prove it to us. Prove it to us.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like that's one of the things that I've struggled with most of my life, especially growing up. My dad was a pastor and, you know, people just look at you and expect you to be perfect. Mm-hmm. And it's just really easy to get this feeling of I'm, in a sense, better than some of these other people, which I hate saying those words, but sometimes you just have that feeling. And yeah, that's something I feel like I've always kind of struggled with, and especially it manifests itself in being a people pleaser, and wanting people to like me and wanting to be popular. And a lot of it is rooted in pride and in wanting to have my own kingdom, I guess. Yeah. So I think it's definitely something that kind of resonates with me, at least.
Yeah. Here's where that worked well for me, because my dad was a pastor, but he quit the pastorate before I was born. So by the time I came around, I could just do whatever. All my siblings had to live under that cloud. So it was good. I was just freewheeling it. But good. What about you, Brennan?
I never really thought about it until I actually read this article. I wouldn't have really walked around thinking, oh, I have a really, you know, I'm egotistical or I have a problem with it. But as I looked at some of these examples, it's like, oh, wow.
You're like,
I actually am, you know, and it's it's not maybe externally projected as much as it's internal, you know, especially like as we start talking through some of these things, you know, the change, that's probably one that really kind of hit me in the gut was that it, you know, ego does not like change and I do not like change.
Yeah.
So therefore... You know, it is a form of ego. But.
Yeah, I think it's something I've wrestled with my entire life. And I feel like in my life, especially those points where the Lord has blessed me with opportunity or ability, those are places where ego really shows up, where I tend to compare myself with others and compare myself favorably compared to others. It's just something that you just see kind of crop up, especially where, you know, you might... like lose at something that you shouldn't have lost at, or maybe you get passed over and somebody else is picked in front of you. Those are the times where you kind of feel this wait, what? Why would you pick that person over me? Or, and you kind of, I kind of feel that like kind of swirling where it's like, okay, like time to humble yourself and remember that you're not as great as you think you are.
Mm-hmm. No, it's good. Well, let's back it up because Brandon did allude to the first point that the article makes, and that's that the ego hates change above all else. I thought this was interesting. When your ego's in charge, you love comfort and the status quo. Which I guess would mean, you know, it kind of plays into that idea of control and what you know and what you know you can accomplish or work within the parameters of and stuff. I thought it was very interesting that one of the examples here, you know, Jesus giving the sermon and saying, basically making the command repent, which is an ultimate example of change. So a heart change, a complete 180 in that sense. But why, Brandon, we'll start with you since that one hit you. Why is change so difficult for you? What do you think? And why does it play into ego? Why did this one resonate?
I think, like you said, it's like a control issue. You know, there's good change and there's change that's just more environmental. So, you know, like a routine. I'm very routine based. And so I think it almost, if I take a step back and look at it, it's like anything that rocks the boat for me, you know, it becomes all about me. It's like, you know, being kind of the whole introverted type of thing. You're making it about you when you can't kind of adapt to that change. And that shows that there is an ego there. There's healthy change, obviously. I mean, you know, wanting to hit a goal or to do something to better yourself, that's one change. But I think I just look at it as the day-to-day, like, oh, you know, now I have to do this, or, you know, I like doing it this way. But now, you know, change management, the kind of the area that I work in, you know, in the ministry, we deal a lot with that, just with things changing and having to kind of to walk people through that. And it's funny that I do that, yet at the same time, I can be resistant and not like change as well, because it becomes inconvenient for me, essentially.
Yeah, that's true. You know, well, maybe it helps when you're working with other people's change, and then it's you can leave it at the end of the day.
That
all of a sudden,
true.
When it's your project, and it's like, what? What do I have to change? Anyone else have change issues? Not like you're getting ready to move.
Yeah. The change of moving, I think that, like, I think about it in terms of the change of growth. Mm-hmm. You think about any time you're going to learn something or you're going to grow in any way, you have to first come to a place where you see your need for growth. Mm-hmm. And I think that you know, that humbling and saying, you know what, I can't do this. I need something else in order to be able to do something that I want to do, and being able to take that risk, you're really risking, like, your own, you know, your own failure. Mm-hmm. Any growth, you really have to attempt things that you don't know how to do. You have to risk embarrassing yourself. You have to risk, like, all these things that are an attack to your ego. So I think the reason we don't like change is we're fearful of what if this doesn't work out? Mm-hmm. So we're getting ready to move to San Diego and you know, start a new job there. And I do think that the part of the fear is, what if this doesn't go well? Mm-hmm. Like, what if this job doesn't work out? Or what if we don't find a place to live? All these fears that can creep in. Mm-hmm. And really, those fears kind of grow out of this, man, I really want people to think that I make good decisions and I do good things and that I can handle anything that comes my way. Mm-hmm. And so I think ego really shows up where it's, you're really like, you don't want to do anything or take any risk that could open you up to being embarrassed.
Yeah.
And so the person who deals with ego and humbles himself is like, yeah, if I fail, that's okay. I'll learn from that failure. I mean, so many, when you start reading books on success, so many people have built success on failures. And there's so many illustrations of people that failed and failed and failed and failed and failed and then succeeded. And they look back and they're like, oh, all those failures were part of my success. Mm-hmm. And so ego can keep us from that. If you're afraid to fail at anything, then change will be hard and you might have an ego problem.
Yeah. You know what kind of change I love? Changing other people.
Like, I thought you were going to say change at the store.
Like pocket,
well, that too.
I like pocket change.
Yeah.
But I just think to myself, like, how many times I look at other people and I'm like, if only they weren't like that, then I wouldn't be like this. Like my reaction towards people. And like, I am reacting to them this way because they are such a jerk, or they are so dumb, or they are so, you know. And I'm always like, you know, why can't they just change, or why can't they grow, or what's their problem, or whatever? And so I think turning it back on myself is probably a good exercise in that. All right. I thought this one was good. Minimizing sins of the heart and focusing instead on sins of the flesh. Mm. This is a great example for, you know, those of you that mentioned the comparison trap as well, because what you can see is easy to judge and say, oh, yeah, well, at least I'm not like that. But all of a sudden, you know, you can run the mental list of, yeah, here was a time where I classic case of what I just shared. Look down on someone or wish that they were different or wish that, you know, they weren't infringing on my rights or saying something that I didn't like or didn't agree with. I don't know. What'd you guys think? What'd you guys think about that one?
It reminded me of the parable in, I think it's Luke 18, where it talks about there's like two men praying at the temple, and one of them is a Pharisee and the other one's a tax collector. And the Pharisee says, like, thank you, God, that I'm like so righteous and I'm not as bad as this tax collector. And he says, like, you know, this really righteous and holy prayer. And then the tax collector is kind of off by himself in the corner and he just asks God to have mercy on him. And then the passage goes on to say, like, woe is the Pharisee, because he's proud, and like God will exalt the humble, basically. And it just kind of reminded me of that story, and that it's so easy sometimes to be just like the Pharisee and to think, oh, I'm so much better because I look like this on the outside and because I know all the right answers and I've studied at church. And it's easy to think you're so perfect. But then I was reading, like, in preparation for this, in Matthew 23, it says, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you clean the outside of the cup and plate, but are inside full of greed and self-indulgence. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you are like whitewashed tombs, which are outwardly appear beautiful, but inwardly are full of dead people's bones and uncleanliness. Which is like, whoa, that's so harsh. But I think a lot of us kind of, like, we care so much about what looks like on the outside and looking like we're so perfect when really our heart is dead. And I don't know. I've definitely been there before. And so that's what I thought about.
Our culture celebrates that, sadly, though. I mean, we live in a time where it's like that, what you look like, you know, have it all together on the outside. That's what... as long as you can do that, then, you know, that's what success is. And it's hard to see. It's sad to see when people, you know, are just a wreck or a mess inside. But as long as they can project outwardly that they're fine, you know, and it's those, it is those sins of the heart that, I don't know, for some reason, they just seem kind of easier to overlook or to kind of to bury, like, you know, back to that comparison thing. Well, at least it's not this, you know, I struggle with this thing, but at least it's not that. So, you know, it's not so bad, but, it's one of those slippery slopes though, too. It's kind of the one of those things that if you don't get it under control, you don't identify it, it's going to come up and it can have a big impact. You know, it's kind of that rotting from the inside out. Like that tree that looks strong until you cut it open and it's not healthy.
Well, and here's a great example of this one. Let's move to the next one. The people that just constantly need praise or credit, like, you know, they have to be recognized. They have to feel special. They have to, and they're reluctant to give that to other people. I mean, in this, I'm reminded of before we started taping, we were talking about Beth Moore, because I do some of her studies. And, but I remember her saying one time how she felt very convicted that even with the platform that she has, it's very important that she, I think she called it praying and pushing other teachers, leaders, whatever, forward. How can she shine the spotlight on them and a great thing that they're teaching or something that they're doing or something that she learned from someone else rather than making it about her? Because someone like her could easily get caught up in the spotlight or the number of Twitter followers or how many Bible studies she sold or whatever. And so it's one of those things of, I think for me, I have to be very conscious about that. I'm not just like, hey, let me just, you know, think everyone else is amazing and elevate them. I don't know. Do we feel like we're kind of praise hungry in a way?
Yeah, I think that that's a really good indicator, because it is a sign that your ego is out of control if you feel threatened by the success of others, especially when they're being successful at something that you want to see accomplished. I've recently been reading a book on Abraham Lincoln's leadership. And one of the big points they make in the book is that Lincoln was quick to praise others when things went well, but he would take the blame when his generals would mess up or when they would lose a battle. He would defer to himself and say, this was my fault. You know, here's how we can do better. But if the battle went well, then he would give the generals praise publicly. And I just thought that just is like, really encapsulates his own humility, that he was secure enough in himself. And at the same time, he's undergoing a lot of criticism from people for being in the war and all this kind of stuff. Sorry, I won't make this a history lesson, but.
Who was Lincoln? Who are you talking about?
Abraham.
Oh yeah, okay.
On the penny and $5 bill. But so I think for me, like, I look at that and I'm like, in my own life, Like when other people on your team do something great and everybody kind of focuses on them, is there something inside of you that's like, hey, wait, I like made that happen, or I had a big part to play in that, and I, you know. So I think, especially as a leader, you have to be willing to defer credit to other people and want to see your team thrive, mm-hmm. and be willing to be the last to acknowledge when things go well. But then when things don't go well, you're willing to own that and say, you know what, guys, this is on me, and we're gonna make a change and do this better.
Hmm. All right. Well, there are a couple here that I want to kind of combine together in the interest of time. One of them is that ego seeks immediate gratification and despises anything hard or uncomfortable. I mean, this is like, who isn't this, is what I want to know. I don't know many people that are going after this. And then the last one being ego is overly sensitive and easily offended. And I think this is kind of a hallmark of where we are today, too. I mean, everything, mm-hmm. you see people like screaming on social media. You see people leaving churches because someone put their nose out of joint for some reason or another. And just choosing not to do the hard thing. I mean, I feel like I am always gravitating towards comfort. I mean, I can't even tell you how many Groupons I want to buy for massages. I'm just always, I'm just like, my whole life is obsessed about like, can I buy this Groupon for this massage and can I fit it in? And I'm like, Lisa, you don't need to always be getting massages and sitting around and being comfortable, sitting in spas. Can't do it. So I don't know. What do you guys think?
I like the phrase that ego seeks a quick fix, and I know that's true in my life. No one likes to have to struggle through something, but it's usually in the midst of that struggle is when you grow and when you're truly molded and defined and you learn. But it's having to, number one, think about having to do that, and number two, actually having to go through it. And so it kind of plays back up to number one, where ego hates change. I mean, anything that is hard or uncomfortable that you know is going to take effort to make work or make better, it's not fun. And so your ego kind of tries to tell you that it's not worth the time or the effort to do it. You know, it's kind of, again, selfish and looking back towards yourself saying, you know, if it's hard for you, then you don't have to do it. You can just walk away and you lose out on a lot.
Yeah, I think of like, especially the last one, sensitive or easily offended. It's so easy to see every person in your life as like this mirror where you're constantly trying to see yourself. And they actually, psychologists say that in middle school, we do this. Like when we're trying to form our identity for the first time, we look to other people and we first gauge how do other people see us. And that's how we start to form our own identity. And I think that even into adulthood, we continue to do this. And it's so hard for us when somebody that's close to us or knows us well, you know, might say something or express something that kind of breaks us down a little bit, where it's like, oh, wow. And so I feel like we need to get back to a place where we allow close people in our lives to speak truth into our lives, even if it's painful. I think a lot of people don't want to give that hard word and don't want to receive it. And that's really how we're going to grow and have authentic relationships. Like, who in your life will tell you when you need to make a significant change in your life? And I tell you, there are so many people that would say, I would never do that for any of my friends, and I would never want any of my friends to do that for me. And it's sad because you're never going to grow. You're never going to have anything pointed out to you if you're not willing to say, you know what, that was really hard to hear, but thank you. I needed to hear that.
It reminds me of not too long ago, a group of friends just went on a simple Starbucks run and totally, not only did they not ask me to go, but didn't even ask me if I wanted anything. And so when they come back, and I mean, it's like, hello, people, I'm like a grown woman, okay? I mean, but it was very easy to say, immediately go to, oh my goodness, is something wrong? Like, do they not like me? What, you know, and I'm like, or they just spaced it out, Lisa, and they just didn't, you weren't, you know, out of sight, out of mind, you weren't, but immediately we go to, now they hate me, they don't want me part of their friend group, they don't, and it's just like so drama fest, you know, but I could easily go there, even with, you know, oh, just preach truth to yourself, and God doesn't think that way of you, and no one, you know, whatever, and immediately we just go, you know, so.
Yeah.
But I'm going to point it out to him and make it feel bad, so. So they'll get me a free drink. I'm just saying. So, thanks, you guys.
Yeah, you're welcome. Oh, why don't you forgive me?
Hey everyone, here we are for this week's culture segment. I get to welcome back a friend of Boundless, not only a friend of Boundless, but a friend of our friend, Steve Waters, one of the founders of Boundless.org, Dan Dumas. Hey Dan.
Hello Lisa, how are you?
I am doing okay. It is good to have you on the show, or back on the show. Last time we had you on the show, well, you pretty much have only talked about men in the past.
Yeah, I think so.
I don't know
typecast.
If that means...
You typecast me.
That's very true. So today we're going to let you, now that you've done a couple interviews with me, we're going to let you expand your horizons and maybe share some insights for women too. So it's not everyone that gets to do that, just so you know. But
absolutely.
Well, folks, Dan is a teaching pastor and elder at Crossing Church in Louisville, Kentucky. He is, as I mentioned, really an expert on understanding what it means to, specifically for men, biblical manhood, and understanding what it means to grow up in leadership, taking on ownership of your role within the church. But he's also into stuff like expository preaching and transformational ministry and all that. So you've got a lot going on. In fact, you used to be in the Navy as well, right?
Yes, right out of high school. I spent 5 years on a search and rescue team out of Jacksonville, Florida.
Wow. Okay. Well, there's a lot. Do you know that there's some Jacksonville team that just changed their name to like the Jumbo Shrimp or something? I do not know that.
Yeah. That's frightening.
They were like the Jacksonville Suns, whatever team that is, and now they're the Jumbo Shrimp. So that's just a little bit of trivia. I'm just putting it in there. Okay. Well, let's talk about Live Smart, because this is a book that you put together, Preparing for the Future God Wants for You. And really, it is kind of taking your perspective as someone who's a few more years down the road and helping young adults, grow into their future and prepare for it in a way that's pretty much, you know, intentional and wise. So I want to kick it off by, talking about, we referenced the fact that you were a Navy search and rescue specialist. Any correlation? What have you learned between that and then being a teaching pastor and a church elder? What are the skills you've had to carry over?
Yeah, I think each epoch of my life has kind of had one dominant theme. When you reference the military, it would be that discipline is king. That's one of the fringe benefits of being in the military. You kind of go in a little bit sloppy, a little bit naive, and I came out 5 years later with a greater appreciation for discipline. And so that's really marked my whole life and ministry. And I also served in the marketplace. You know, in the marketplace, I learned that relationships were king, and how critical relationships are within organizations. And of course, in ministry, I've learned that character is king, that I can't take people where I'm not going myself personally. And so a dominant theme there would be character is king. So lots of big axiomatic statements, but have shaped my life.
Sure. Well, in talking as we are here today to a young adult audience, I mean, this is a generation, millennials and such, who are all about like self-discovery. So, I mean, we've all taken probably millions of assessments and personality tests, and we're always trying to figure out, you know, through those Facebook quizzes, like how do we relate to other people? But why would you say it's a good idea for people, especially singles in this stage of life, to periodically reevaluate kind of where their life is going, what kind of trajectory they're on? What does that produce in us?
Well, I think it produces, examination produces intentionality. Mm-hmm. The reason I wrote Live Smart is because I think so many 20-somethings are not living with intentionality. And if you never stop, pause, evaluate, examine, edit, then that will not inform your ability to be highly intentional with how you lead, live and lead. So yeah. I think it leads to intentionality.
Yeah. Well, you in the book actually talk about, you know, I don't think it will surprise anyone to know that you're very, you know, you're very serious about saying the first way to even get this whole thing started is to shore up your relationship with God. And you talk about fearing God and then knowing the Bible and really applying it to your life. I mean, there are a lot of us out there that, you know, a lot of young adults maybe don't even know what a true 21st century application of fearing God means. When you're telling us to really pursue God and fear God, what are you saying? What does that look like in a practical sense, Dan?
Yeah, I think to use shorthand, it would be to cultivate a high view of God. Mm. And I believe that you will live out your view of God. So if you have a low view of God, you're going to have a low standard of living. If you have a high view of God, it's going to produce a high standard of living. And so the loftier you can see God, and so you have a high view of God and a low view of man, I think it gives you a healthy worldview, a perspective, and out of that comes a healthy fear of God. So my opinion on the fear of God is not that it mobilizes you and discourages you, but it actually lifts you up and strengthens you and gives you clear perspective and hope. And I think that's where Solomon started in Proverbs 1. He said, the beginning of wisdom is the fear of God. And so that's why I started there in chapter 1 with, listen, you got to fear God.
Yeah. Well, and I think that is so good, a good reminder, because I think there's so much, even within the church today, that's encouraging us to be, you know, buddies with God, or just, you know, fit God into our framework. And what is God going to do for me? And how does God fit into my purpose or my goals for life, and just a lot of nonsense along those lines.
Agreed.
It seems. Yeah. Okay. Well, I want you to talk about, like, when you, one other thing you talk about is you talk about loving the church, and we talk about that a lot here at Boundless, the value of the local church and people, including church leadership, spiritual authorities in your life. So that, in conjunction with what you were saying about fearing God, knowing the Bible, prayer, what are some things, Dan, both in your own life and in others that you know have matured in Christ through some decades? What are the hallmarks? Like, what should be looking different about a person who is really growing in those areas? I just actually read a great article by Tim Keller that was talking about, like, three questions that fake Christians can't answer. And I was thinking, wow, a lot of what you're saying kind of plays into that, too. Like, if you're serious about God, you should have these kind of hallmark attitudes and behaviors in your life. What would be a few suggestions?
Yeah, I think one that stands out, and I just talked on this to our college, and that's, and it says, there's a chapter in the book about it, but in particular, the passion to pursue and seek mentors. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's wise to try to grow up in Christ without mentors. I think you'll always retard your sanctification without them. I think it's a critical path. I'm emphatic about it, and it's my story. I'm a marked man because I had mentors in my life who came alongside of me and helped me grow and aided my growth. And so I think community, a community of people that you should have in your life, helps you become more like Christ. And I don't think you'll ever get to your full potential without that community. And that community in particular is the church, right? I mean, that's mm-hmm. where you're going to find those mentors. And then Solomon said in Proverbs 18:1, he who isolates himself is a fool. So individualism is folly. It's foolish. And you need people in your life. And so there's tons of isolation going on, but I would highly discourage that. I think the people that are highly intentional spiritual leaders and growing godly Christians have lots of people speaking into their life.
Yeah. One thing you kind of put in tandem with that, because I think that is so key, and I think a lot of young adults are, you know, well, what do I do? Just wander around my church and say, who'll be my mentor? And I always say, well, no, like plug into something, like start serving somewhere, because as you do that, you're going to have access to the godly leadership who's in charge of that kind of stuff. That's a, you know, I think a great way to start. But you also then kind of put that hand in hand with choosing your friends wisely. Let's talk a little bit about that, because I think a lot of us try to have like our work friends or the people, you know, the friends that are kind of just stagnant and or if we admit it, pull us down. And then we try to go and have our church friends that are going to have to pull kind of, you know, against that or shore that up. What are some of the great things to look for in a friend, would you say?
Well, I think most importantly, you know, to use the biblical language in Proverbs, it's faithfulness, right? Faithful are the wounds of a friend. Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking for loyalty. I'm looking for friends that are willing to stab me in the front, not stab me in the back. You know, mm-hmm. I want to see the knife coming. I know they have my best interest in mind. I know they care about my soul. I know they're willing to correct. They're willing to inspire. They're willing to encourage. So I'm not just looking for friends that will agree with me. I'm looking for the kind of friends that will pull me aside and say, what were you thinking? Mm-hmm. Are you crazy? Are you an idiot? Stop, you know. Yeah. So I think we all need that kind of friend, the faithful, you know, are the wounds of a friend. And loyalty is the umbrella over all friendship for me. And I think when you choose your friends, you're actually choosing a destiny. Because mm-hmm. if you choose the wrong crowd or the wrong friends, they'll either build you up or they'll tear you down. And so yeah. I'm looking for ones that are going to build me up. But in doing so, they're not just placating to me. They're confronting me. They're in my face, and they're willing to stab me in the front, not the back.
Yeah. To that point, I think you make a few great points in the book about kind of that idea of if you're not actively growing, whether in your faith or whether in character or in even in skills and maturity, you are most likely regressing. You know, there's very, very few people, if anyone, that just kind of stands still or whatever. What would you say, like, what do we, especially, what are those little sneaky thieves, I guess, that can sneak into our life and all of a sudden we wake up, you know, 3, 4, 5 years later and we're like, wow, this really was either a time sapper or an energy or a character sapper. What are the things that are particularly problematic for this generation when it comes to that?
Well, in particular, you know, you're speaking to millennials, and I know we are. I would say watch your social media. You know, I mean, I love social media. I deploy social media. I enjoy social media, but it can really, you know, it can really distract. So I just set disciplines in my own life where the first thing I do is get up and I get in the Word. I think that's absolute critical path. So the Word and prayer, the two wings of sanctification, they're the two primary wings, not the only, but the two primary. And so I make sure before I, you know, check Twitter or check Facebook or Instagram, I'm checking in with God and His Word. And I just think that's a critical path. And it's one you just have to work at. I mean, I know that at times it's a bit distracting, and mm-hmm. I can just be my own spiritual voyeurism, kind of looking at stuff and just get distracted. Next thing I know, an hour and a half's gone away. I'm like, what in the world have I done? So just making sure that you're grounded in the Scriptures and you're grounded in prayer and grounded in your local church. And when you're doing relationships, you're doing them, you know, eye to eye, not just, you know, piece of technology to eye, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's good. I think that goes hand in hand. I mean, obviously, there are, you know, the negatives, and we could easily, probably, with some self-examination, pick the things in our own lives, whether it's binge-watching TV or, like you said, social media. It could be just hanging out with the wrong kinds of friends, whatever. But you give some positives that I think would counteract that, and that is to take more risks and to just work hard. I think there are a lot of young adults in this generation who just kind of want to be awesome, but they, you know, there's time and attention and, like you said, character that goes into that. And, you know, kind of the idea, you even talk about procrastination in there. What would you say are some hallmarks of how will working hard and taking the appropriate risks pay off for a person as they head into their 20s and 30s?
Yeah, I think, you know, it comes back to they're willing to take risks because they're being intentional. And that's, I think risk is a biblical concept. You know, I point to Luke 19 where, you know, they have a parable, an ancient story where Jesus said, look, there's these three guys, you know, one guy invested his mine and returned tenfold and he was rewarded 10 cities. And then there's a guy that did five and he got five cities. And then this one cat comes out and he says, look what I did, Jesus. I didn't do anything. I just kind of buried it in a handkerchief. I think that's a lot of the generation. They're taking their mina, their stewardship, and they're burying it in a handkerchief and they're not being intentional with it. And as you know, in that parable, Lisa, they're condemned for that behavior. And the ones that are blessed are the ones that took the risk. And so I think risk is very much a part of the faith. I think the flesh and the devil are risk adverse. And so I think that the people who are highly intentional, who are willing to take appropriate risk, I think that's a great modifier, appropriate risk. But what you notice in that parable, the ones that took risk, they didn't get to chill. They didn't get have more margin, they were given more responsibility. So they were a five-city guy and a 10-city guy. So for what they did, the risk they took, which was magnanimous and pretty awesome, they got more responsibility. So as you grow in your faith and as you grow up in Christ, you realize that faithfulness is rewarded with a deeper faithfulness, a deeper understanding of God, more risk, more stewardship, more hard work. And then that's part of the faith that you know, God's called us to do hard things, hard gospel things. Mm-hmm. And so I strongly encourage them, young people to be, you know, 20-somethings, to be highly intentional, take risks, don't sit back, be a little more aggressive to engage in opportunities, whether it's a short-term mission trip, the local church, a rescue mission, whatever it is, do something. Get your feet moving and take action. And I think that produces that spiritual moxie that causes someone to lead and to step out on faith and to do those kinds of things.
Yeah. I really like how in part four of the book, you kind of bring it back to the gospel and an understanding that the gospel isn't just, you know, that thing that's your ticket to heaven and then you just kind of like chuck it over to the side. But it's central to what we believe and how we live our lives and really how we look forward to eternity. If you were to look, Dan, at a couple people, you know, kind of saints that you really admire, how is the gospel like transforming the way that they live their life? And how has it affected the, whether it's the culture around them, whether it's been individual lives? I mean, kind of paint a picture for where spiritual maturity truly does have the power to affect change and transformation.
Yeah, I mean, I think first, when I think of individuals that are kind of flooding my mind right now, I think of prideful men that God turned into amazingly humble men. I mean, they were full of themselves, and now they're full of Christ. You know, they looked out for number one, and now they look out for everyone else, which is a byproduct of the gospel or an implication of the gospel. I mean, when you think about living and leading, I mean, it's about giving yourself away. So I look at people who are just categorically full of themselves, encounter the gospel, fall in the mercies of God, and they turn into a servant. Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly what Jesus did. The night before he's killed, he sat down, you know, with his disciples, and he picked a basin up and a towel, and he washed their feet, and that became the forever symbol of living and leading a gospel-centered life, that it would be through humility and through serving others. And so when I think of epic saints, guys and gals that have led through both church history and present, I'm looking for the hallmark there, and that's humility, serving one another, giving yourself away. So every single day, I get out of bed, I put my feet on the floor, and I think, who can I serve today? Where can I give myself away? I don't even want to worry about what's going to happen to me because I know God will take care of me. Jesus said, it's more blessed to give than it is to receive. And so I'm a giver because he's a giver. He's the archetype. And I think you look at strong leaders through history, strong leaders present, you're going to see the hallmark of humility, servanthood, and giving yourself away.
Well, to get you started, we want to make this book available. So for a gift of any amount, we're going to actually get this book in your hands. If you go to boundless.org, you can look and find the actual resource there. Click on it. Again, a gift of any amount, we're going to send this book to you, and this is going to be a great guide to get you started. So maybe one for yourself, maybe one for a friend. You can do this together and really spur one another on now in 2017 to kind of move further in your maturity and Christ. And see what that does to yourself and to the people around you. So, thanks so much.
Thank you, Lisa, for the opportunity.
All right. Let's make it count. Let's make it worthwhile. The battle is ahead, and we need to face it. No turning back. Folks, as we finish out the show, we are here with our inbox and the super duper friend of Boundless, Joshua Rogers. Hey, Joshua.
Hey, Lisa.
Awesome to have you back. And again, we are seeking out your advice for one of the guys in our listenership here. So you hopefully will have some great wisdom for him. He says, one of my coworkers seems to be trying to get my attention by giving me noticeable compliments and going out of her way to ask for my help. Frankly, I'm not interested. Simply not asking her out doesn't seem to be a clear enough option, but I don't want to go out of my way to tell her off either. I don't really know this girl well enough to be too blunt. Am I reading too much into this, and this is just her trying to be friendly? Is there a good way to navigate this situation?
Thank you so much for asking this question. I appreciate it in particular because, as Lisa knows, this is one of my pet peeve areas. You can go check out an article I wrote that did really well at Boundless called Your Friend Girl Deserves Better. This is an area that is fraught with peril because men and women sometimes end up in these friendlationships where usually I find after college it tends to be more so men that are encouraging relationships that aren't going anywhere. There are exceptions. Yes, I know there are. But for you in this situation, I would say this. The only person you've got control over is yourself. You don't have any responsibility for how this woman feels. You do have responsibility for how you treat her. And your responsibility is to keep your eyes open for anything you're doing to encourage a relationship that isn't actually going to happen. And I'd say the thing that you need to be thinking about is reciprocation. So here are three questions you can ask yourself, and I'm sure you can think of others. But number one, is there anything in me that enjoys the attention she gives? Because if it is, you're naturally going to encourage this. And in doing so, you end up in this cycle of reciprocation. So the second question would be, if I do kind of enjoy that attention, what might I be doing to encourage her to keep flirting with me or engaging with me? If it's more overt and you're slightly conscious of it, it's going to be like, hey, want to go to lunch, or having long phone conversations with her, or possibly, you know, just messaging a lot back and forth with her at work. The third thing, though, is that I'd say is there are times where, you know, men like you aren't really trying to do anything that would encourage the assumption that you're attracted. But there might be something you're doing that looks like reciprocation with someone who's really hoping you're interested, and it might not be much. So if so, why don't you stop and evaluate, is there any degree to which I'm doing that? And, you know, you don't have to sit down and have a come-to-Jesus meeting with her. What you can do is don't stop by her cubicle anymore. When she comes by to have a 15-minute conversation, keep it at 3. When she says, hey, you want to go to lunch with me and my girlfriends? You say, no, that's okay. You're going to have to put up boundaries, and you know what's going to happen? She's going to feel it. And when she does, she's going to get her feelings hurt. That's fine. You're not being mean. You're doing her a favor, because what's going to happen is if she gets the sense that actually you are reciprocating because you like her, this is eventually going to end in like a crash and burn of a friendlationship that was never going anywhere in the first place. So I don't know a lot about you, but that's what I would want someone to do to me, even if it would hurt, because I don't want to be strung along accidentally. You don't either. do what you would want her to do for you if the shoe was on the other foot.
Yeah, those are great points, Joshua. And I think it's so helpful even for women who are listening to hear kind of from a guy's point of view what kind of advice needs to be given in this. So that is super. One thing I was going to say, too, is you mentioned the whole like if she asks you to do lunch and whatever. I think a great thing to say that kind of puts her in the coworker camp is just to say, you know what? No, I'm not really interested in that because I really want to keep our relationship professional. I mean, there is no there's no way that she can misinterpret that. OK. So you are clearly delineating like, nope, you're a coworker. And so that's not going to happen. Anyway, I don't know, just another little way that you could probably say something. I mean, bless your heart, listener, for saying this. And I thank you for not wanting to tell her off or not being unkind. So hopefully you'll take Joshua's advice to heart and try to, you know, act rather than react, you know, come up with your game plan for how you're going to nip this in the bud. Okay, folks, that is it for this week's show. We do want to hear from you. Write to us at editor@boundless.org and submit your question. You can also go to boundless.org and search past questions if you think you have something that we might have addressed that maybe you're going through right now. We would love to speak into that if we have the opportunity. Make sure you're also hopping over to iTunes and give us a review on iTunes because that is what lets other people know that the show exists. It kind of brings other people into our sphere, so that's really helpful too. So if this show has meant something to you, go over to iTunes and leave us a review. That's it for this week's show. I'm Lisa Anderson for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.